calculations are correct, when this baby hits 88 miles per hour, you're gonna see some serious shit.
To August 28th, 86 for this episode of Wrestling History 101.
Indeed, and unlike yourself, I wasn't even alive.
You were still minus 2 years old.
Yep.
And I went to the movies again this past weekend.
Yes, you were telling me the movie wasn't very good.
I was so bored. I really didn't understand the point of this movie. It's this new movie based on the Stephen King short story called Stand By Me. I just found it altogether boring. I might get a lot of hate for this because apparently it's one of these iconic movies of 86, but I didn't see anything special about it.
Well, I mean, and do you know how boring the movie must have been for Elio to say that? Because in general, you know, for a Stephen King story to be considered bad is blasphemous. Because I'm a Stephen King fan myself.
Like, his movies are not good. Like, there are, like, a few that are good. The Shining, I love. Misery, I loved. Dolores Claiborne was fine.
And it and the sequel wasn't that bad.
Which one?
It.
Oh.
It 1 and It 2. Those were pretty good.
So, like, okay, I'm looking it up on this great invention I brought back with me called an iPad. I'm looking up the synopsis. I'm gonna read you the synopsis and you tell me if this sounds like a movie you'd watch. Okay. Stand By Me. After the death of one of his friends, a writer recounts a childhood journey with his friends to find the body of a missing boy.
Well, I mean, it sounds interesting, but you know, it really depends on the execution of the acting, I guess.
Like, I mean, apparently it got an 8 out of 10, and there's like all these actors like River Phoenix and Corey Feldman are in it, but still, the only good thing I liked about the movie is the music, because it's all from the 60s.
Well, and, you know, I'm not a 60s music guy. I'm more of an 80s, 90s rock metal guy. So that's more up your alley than it is mine.
And stay tuned for the main show, because we're going to have a ginormous battle of bands tournament coming up that Ben is going to be booking.
Yes, I'm very much looking forward to that. And, and we will be back to the normal show on Saturday.
Yes.
You're getting a double dose of Wrestling History 101 because of the Crown Jewel. Thank God that's in the rearview mirror.
I almost want to go back and see it just to see Kairi Sane's appearance, because she showed up at the pay-per-view.
Well, apparently, and this was the only bit I saw, because people were reacting to it online. I didn't catch this on the pay per view, because I didn't watch a single solitary second of it. Right. Because why would I? Right. But I saw people reacting to it online, and apparently, she got no reaction whatsoever. Upon her return, which
there's people that don't know who she is.
But That given that audience, that's understandable, right? But my, so I'm not really blaming the audience in this particular instance. I blame WWE because why would you bring Kairi Sane back in that situation? Why would you bring the only people that the Saudi audience are gonna know if you bring them back are like legends, you know what I mean? Like if you bring John Cena back in Saudi, obviously they're gonna know who he is, or like they've done Hogan in the past, or Goldberg or Taker. But you know, Kairi Sane is not going to garner that reaction that she deserves, quite frankly. Because I was always a Kairi Sane fan. I was kind of disappointed when she left WWE the first time. But the reaction that she received is just pathetic. So it was very unfair for her to be placed in that situation. So that is just a microcosm of why we're not talking about the Crown Jewel pay-per-view. From what I've heard, it wasn't necessarily a bad show, but it was a very predictable show. So I don't think you guys are missing anything there from us from a potential review perspective.
This show is gonna be more fun.
Absolutely.
And then
And then
what?
the regular show will be back on Saturday because then we get to some very important stuff because we have the Road to Survivor Series starting and also the final build for Full Gear. So we kind of took some time off for Crown Jewel because who gives a fuck? But now that that's in the rearview mirror, we'll start getting some serious work done here. So stick with us in the latter part of the year.
All right, so Ben, let me ask you a question. What is stranger than pay-per-view on a Monday night?
Well, in terms of wrestling, I don't know.
A pay-per-view on a Thursday night, because what do you say we get into the big event?
Well, partially, I gotta be honest with you, partially, I don't, I'm kind of like, do we have to? But that is not to say I'm not interested in this show. Obviously, I'm very interested in getting your take on this, because from my perspective, even the matches I was looking forward to, after looking at the synopsis, I'm like, why was this even a thing? But you don't listen to these shows for the reviews necessarily. You listen to it for the historical aspect of it. So that's what I think you guys are gonna find interesting in this show. So let's get into that.
So it is Thursday, August 28th, 1986. The CNE Fairgrounds in Toronto, Ontario, Canada. Ben, first of all, let me ask you, after you watch this, I was 12 years old. I wanted to go see this. Do you think I made a good decision not going?
Yes, I do. Because number one, now this is just a disabled guy speaking to another disabled guy. So Elio will appreciate this. the crowd would have been impossible for you to navigate because I think they said there were 65 to 75 to 70,000 people there in that outdoor space. And I don't think it would have been very easy for you to get around. So I think you dodged a bullet just watching this from your couch.
And I remember at this time, the previous month was July, and even going down to Florida, I was like sitting in like a carriage because I had casts on my legs because I just had surgery. So I think it would have been even worse navigating that way.
Yeah, that would have been damn near impossible.
Right, so let's get into the big event. So the opening match we have the Killer Bees versus Jimmy Jack Funk and Hoss Funk, or Dory Funk Jr.
Why can't we just call them Terry Funk and Dory Funk?
No, actually, because that wasn't Terry Funk. That was Jimmy Jack Funk. He was
Well,
yet another relative of the Funks. And I have information on him. Now, Jimmy.
it was an actual funk. It wasn't just a storyline relative, or was it?
Well, no, it was a storyline relative. See, because I'm gonna here's a backstory on Jimmy Jack Funk. His real name is Farron Barr. He was born April 14, 1959. He's an American retired professional wrestler who made appearances in Championship Wrestling from Florida and then was renamed Jesse Barr. And then
Yeah, I have no recollection of that, to tell you the truth.
Jesse Barr joined the World Wrestling Federation under the ring name Jimmy Jack Funk, where he wrestled with the Lone Ranger mask on.
Yeah, you look like the fucking Hamburglar.
Now, Ben, have you ever heard of a promoter named Sandy Barr?
No.
Okay, so Jesse Barr or Farron Barr is the son of this promoter. So he competed under the ring names The Assassin, Jesse Barr, Jimmy Jack Funk, and JJ Funk. And he was built from the Double Cross Ranch as part of the Funk Brothers.
Oh, okay. Well,
But yeah, so that was him. He didn't last too long in the WWF.
yeah, well, especially when you try to associate somebody with the funks when they're not actually a funk,
Right.
I don't see that working out very well. Because the funks are so beloved. So I think saddling somebody with that gimmick, you're putting the behind the eight ball to begin with. Now, in terms of the match, was it a bad match? No. But they did the whole talking about the Killer Bees. They did kind of like some twin magic bullshit, because they put their mask on mid-match, so obviously the ref couldn't tell which one was which.
So you don't to understand that, right? There's a story behind that.
No.
Oh yeah, I'll explain that to you after you're done.
So the finish was very weird to me because, I get them both being under mask, but still, in terms of like the body types and stuff, like they're not twins. Like you should have been able to tell the difference. Maybe that's me being too literal, but and I know in terms of wrestling, referees aren't the smartest, or the sharpest knives in the drawer, but Jesus Christ. That was a little bit pathetic. It's not as if we had Nikki and Brie Bella in the ring.
Who? That is 1986. Who are you talking about? I've never heard of them.
Trust me, you're gonna wish you haven't.
Okay, so first of all, before I give you the story, what do you think of the Killer Bees? Because, like, growing up, I was a fan of this team in 85, 86.
Well, from what I saw, they were quite entertaining for their time period. I've seen interviews with B. Brian Blair, courtesy of Dark Side of the Ring. He's been featured in several episodes. I'm not sure if I'd ever seen Jumping Jim Brunzel before. I'm gonna err towards the side of no. Because I think I would have remembered had I seen more of the Killer Bees. But from this match, I would like to see more, because I think if you put them in a 20-minute match, I would have been very entertained.
All right, so the story behind the mask. So basically, the mask was kind of like what you said, with that twin magic type deal. So it was more or less to confuse their opponents. They started doing this in one of their feuds. I can't think of which one it was, but I'm gonna look that up momentarily, real quick.
Okay, on the fly research, folks. See, this is where one time I had Elio dub in the Jeopardy theme, but I'm not sure if I'm gonna do that again, because then it just gets repetitive.
So I believe it was it doesn't really show what team exactly they were feuding with, but they introduced their mask as sort of as a ring tactic to confuse their opponents. So rather than wearing the mask in the ring, they would put their mask on mid-match to do just that, confuse their opponent as to which Killer Bee was actually in the ring at the time.
Well, and you'd think that the ref would catch on to that.
Well, that's why I think one of them would keep I don't know, but I think one of them would keep the shot, or they would distract it, or the ref would be busy trying to tend to the other team because they'd be over there breaking rules and entering the ring without tagging.
Yeah.
So that would enable the Killer Bees to put their masks on and make switch, and the referee could never tell which one was actually in the ring.
Yeah, so that was like an early snippet of Twin Magic, as we were saying, but it didn't have the same effect, because
No.
newsflash, they're not twins.
Right. So, do you have anything to add?
No,
All
I'm
right.
good.
Second match, we had Magnificent Morocco versus King Tonga, which ended in a 20-minute time limit draw.
And to me, I wanted to see more of this. But however, the one that, when they were actually working and doing their thing and not in the middle of rest holds, because it was blatantly obvious. See, this is the one thing that they do in wrestling that I just cannot stand. When it is announced ahead of time that, we're gonna have a 20-minute time limit, or it's a 60-minute Ironman match, you know it's going to the time limit, or it's going to be a tie when the time limit runs out. We saw that with MJF and Brian Danielson in AEW when they had their Iron Man match. So it kind of puts the wrestlers behind the eight ball, when you announce these stipulations ahead of time, because now they have to kill time for the express purpose of making it to the time limit draw, which in and of itself, that hurts the match. Whereas if they were working with the urgency because they have to win before the time limit runs out, because there needs to be a winner, then that adds something to it. But when a draw is an option, and the wrestlers don't really lose anything if there's a draw, then the match loses all of its effectiveness for me. And as interested as I am in both King Tonga, who would later become known as Haku or Mang in WCW, Haku obviously in WWF. It's kind of hard to take me out of his matches, but they succeeded here. So not that that's a bad thing all the time, but I just wasn't really interested.
Now, this was his rookie year, and where he made a name for himself by attempting to slam Big John Studd, and then where in similar to what Studd and Andre did, where Bobby Heenan offered $15,000 to anyone who could do that,
Yeah.
and then after that he went on to become tag team with Tama. And then, of course, they were faces, then they turned heel, and they recruited Bobby Heenan as their manager.
Good stuff. Gotta love Bobby's brain, Heenan.
Then we had, now, okay, you know what? I'm kind of glad I didn't go, because this match, I would have been bored out of my mind with this match, because I've never seen either of these two, and I don't really care about either of these. Ted Arcidi defeating Tony Garea. Of course, Tony Garea would go on to become an agent for WWF, a road agent.
Absolutely. And from I looked him up ahead of time, talking about Tony Garea's opponent, Ted Arcidi. Apparently he's a strong man.
Well, that he was billed as a strong man, Ted Arcidi, yes.
Yes. This was a very boring, unnecessary 2 minute 41 minute match.
Right.
Or 2 minute 41 second match.
Yep.
But what its purpose was, I'm not really sure.
No.
Now, the one benefit that this match had is after the match, we finally got a pause in the action, because I don't know if you noticed this, Elio, but there were very rapid fire in terms of like, the matches coming into the ring. Like I think only one person got an entrance that whole time, and I think that was Junkyard Dog
Oh, okay.
early in the show. I don't even recall another entrance happening until Hulk Hogan
No.
got one in the main event.
No, I actually every match both wrestlers were always in the ring. I didn't see any entrances.
Yeah, it was really it was just very interesting.
And I think we can get a couple more in before we go into commercial. But speaking of Junkyard Dog, that brings us to the next match. Junkyard Dog defeating Adrian Adonis.
Which, this adorable Adrian Adonis gimmick,
Yeah.
I get that we had seen gimmicks before this time, and of course after, with
Right.
like Gorgeous George and different people like that, but this was not working.
No. It's like I said during WrestleMania 2. I mean, This guy was a legit tough guy. He used to come to the ring wearing that hat that Ridge Holland wears, and the leather jacket, and he was a tag team champion in AWA and WWF. Why do you need to change his gimmick? I don't understand.
Well, I don't either because, much like not that I'm comparing these two talent wise, because Adrian Adonis was so far and above, but it's like when Quincy Elliott was still with WWE, I was so distracted by his gimmick that I couldn't focus on anything he was doing in the ring. I don't think I was missing anything with Quincy Elliott, but I was certainly missing something with Adrian Adonis because Adrian Adonis was a very talented wrestler. I wasn't focused on that because the dude was wearing a dress with some of the worst makeup I've ever seen in my entire fucking life.
Okay, and then our next match, another useless random match with a couple of names I don't really care for, except the one I kind of was a fan, even though he was enhancement talent. Dick Slater defeating Iron Mike Sharp. I love Iron Mike Sharp. Just like his in-ring mannerisms. Like, he was
Yeah,
like
and
ultimate
then
heel.
at one point in the match, he was like, "Oh no!" And you could hear that loud as fuck. I'm not really sure what, we have two back to actually three back to back squash matches. I'm really not sure what the point of that is. But then again, you have to keep in mind, folks, and we've said it again and again as we continue to go through these 80s reviews as we get this Wrestling History 101 lesson plan underway. The 80s were a different time, but cards like this really are exhibits of just that.
But I love how Mike Sharp his whole in-ring, like he used to like growl and do all that stuff. It was hilarious. Alright, we are going to continue on with the big event now. The next match we have is Bobby Heenan, King Kong Bundy, and Big John Studd versus The Machines with Captain Lou Albano. The Machines are made up of Super Machine and Giant Machine. Now, Ben, do you know the store backstory here?
I don't know the backstory, but I know who they are.
Alright, so of course, Super Machine is masked superstar or Axe of Demolition, and of course, Giant Machine. If you didn't know, it was Big John Studd, but then again, how would you not know? Because it's kind of obvious.
Actually, Super Machine,
So it was Big Machine, not Giant Machine. Giant Machine was in the corner.
Super Machine was Andre the Giant, which is like the worst kept secret I've ever seen in my entire
No,
life.
Super Machine was Axe of Demolition. Giant Machine was Andre the Giant.
Oh, yep.
All right, so actually, I did not know that Big Machine was Blackjack Mulligan. That was surprising.
I didn't know that either until I pulled out this review.
All right, so backstory here. Now, Andre and no, sorry, yeah, Big John Studd and King Kong Bundy had been feuding with Andre the Giant. Now, of course, this stems from Studd and Andre's feud where Bundy got involved. So it was during a match, I can't recall exactly when, but Andre was in the ring after the match. He was attacked by Studd and Bundy and laid out. At this point, he had long hair, so after laying him out, Studd and Bundy proceeded to cut his hair. So that's where we get the short hair, Andre.
Yeah, I don't think you want to do that to Andre. That just seems like a very efficient way of shortening your lifespan.
So then there was so then at this point he had disappeared for a while. Then all of a sudden, Captain Lou Albano introduced this new tag team weeks later called the Machines. He had Super Machine and Giant Machine, and upon seeing Giant Machine, Bobby Heenan got in his head that Giant Machine was actually Andre the Giant under a mask, and he was going to
Well,
prove
how could he not have, how,
it.
I mean, like I said, that's like the worst kept secret I've ever seen. That's worse than when, Hulk Hogan tried to be Mr. America.
Well, and Hulk Hogan got involved in this as well because we also had Hulk Machine and Piper Machine.
Exactly.
I'm like, what is going on? So at this point, it started getting to be ridiculous. However, Bobby Heenan, on behalf of his team, challenged the Machines to a match, which was this match at the big event. And of course, Captain Lou, being a former wrestler, he said that he would team up with the Machines, and so Bobby Heenan was a foil for Captain Lou as he teamed up with Studd and Bundy, and that's where we get the six-man tag match.
Yeah, to see Bobby Heenan actually like in the ring was hilarious. Like the little tiny singlet.
And he talks about Andre the Giant. He was wearing the exact same one.
Yeah, exactly.
So, okay, what'd you get from this match, though?
Well, in terms of a match, it was hard to get something from it because it was only a win by DQ situation, the funniest part, even the reviewer whose review I'm using. Mentions how hilarious Heenan looks in his Andre the Giant attire, just like I did. He mentions how he only wants to tag like when everybody's down, much like Paul Heyman does whenever he tagged with Brock back in the day. Obviously this match is gonna end in some kind of chicanery because of Bobby Heenan and Lou Albano being involved. But it's just, was it a fun match because it was so ridiculous? Yes. But was it warranted being on a so-called big event like this? Pardon the pun. But no, I don't think so.
And I really hate disqualification finishes. So, on to the next match. I was looking forward to this match because I was a fan of both of these guys. We had a snake pit match, which essentially is a no holds barred match, and it was
I
between
was gonna ask you that. I'm glad you clarified that right off the bat because, I heard snake pit match and I'm like, wait a second, what makes this a snake
you
pit
know
match?
what? When I heard snake pit match, I'm like, wait a minute. Are they actually gonna be wrestling in a snake pit? What's going on? Right?
Well, I expected it to be somewhat of a gimmick match. I didn't think it was just going to be a no DQ match or no holds barred.
So of course it was Ricky the Dragon Steamboat and Jake the Snake Roberts. This feud began on the Saturday night's main event. Ben, I don't know if you remember this one, this Saturday night's main event.
No, I never saw this. Like I said, I'm just being honest with you
All
guys.
right.
This stuff was before my time.
The Saturday night's main event, it was, I want to say May of 86. It was to have been Jake Snake Roberts versus Ricky the Dragon Steamboat. So Jake Snake Roberts made his way to the ring first. Then Steamboat came out, he's walking up the ramp, but never made it into the ring because Jake attacked him, laid him out with the clothesline, and hit him with the DDT on the concrete. Now, he even told this story where he's like, where a Steamboat told him to give him the DDT, that he could take it, and Shake wouldn't do it. But Steamboat insisted, like, that he could protect himself, right?
Yeah.
So Shake went through with it, laid him out with the DDT, and he actually, he really, for real, hit his head on the concrete. So when they said Excedrin headache, whatever, which is a term they used back then, that was real when he laid him out with the DDT on the concrete.
Well, in retrospect, I think Jake was right to be very hesitant to use that maneuver on the concrete. Because I don't think you have to know about concussions to realize that bashing someone's head on the concrete is not good for their long-term health.
And so Steamboat was out for a while upon his return, because Jake used to bring Damien to the ring, so Ricky Steamboat started bringing the Komodo Dragon to the ring.
That's hilarious.
Right, and so their feud concluded at this big event in a snake pit match.
But yeah, so even in this match, Steamboat hit a I think Steamboat hit a DDT on the concrete, if I'm not mistaken. Let me look. Hold on, I'm going through
On the
the.
fly research.
I'm just making sure. So,
Right.
no, actually, it was he got revenge by using a chair on Roberts because Jake went to get a chair to bash Ricky in the head, but Ricky blocked it and used it on him. And it says right here, it makes sense that Steamboat would do that given that he got hit with a DDT on the floor a while back during that Saturday night's main event that Elio alluded to. So for me, this was easily the match of the night. What was it? Was it a great match per se? No. But given what else we had on this card, which was there was precious little to choose from in terms of quality wrestling, if I'm just being
I'm
honest.
telling you, the first half was like hard to get through.
And well, to be honest with you, man, that's becoming a theme with these 80s pay-per-views, and I'm kind of,
Say, like I said,
as
it's
much,
only gonna get better.
well, and I have faith in you when you say that, but I'm you know what, to be honest with you, I'm kind of nervous for when we get to the early 90s because I know that's when it started getting really cartoony, and I know that we're gonna have this Wrestling History 101 for the foreseeable future. And I'm kind of nervous for when we hit those because we both know how much the early 90s sucked in WWE, especially when you get to 94, 95.
I see around 93 to 95.
Yeah.
And
So
so because 92 was still somewhat okay.
it's gonna start getting really interesting. So just hang out with us as we navigate these early shows.
Well, some of these pay-per-views we've already done, like in 93, so we will skip over those ones, but the ones that we didn't do, we will definitely be covering those.
Absolutely.
So this next match, one year before their Battle of the Full Nelson match at WrestleMania 3, which we covered on episode 63 of the PNC Progression Wrestling Podcast, we had Billy Jack Haynes versus Hercules Hernandez.
This match didn't need to be on there. Quite
I'm
frankly,
telling you, I'm not a fan of Billy Jack Haynes at all. I don't like the character. He's so boring.
and Hercules Hernandez was somewhat interesting for me. Because it was actually through this show that I got introduced to him. Because as I've admitted many times, prior to hooking up with Elio, a lot of my early wrestling knowledge was WCW based, because I, despite the fact that I watched WCW in the early 90s,
I got an idea by you off the air after the show.
yeah, absolutely. So despite the fact that I did watch wrestling in the early 90s, I only came on to WWF in 96. I may have mentioned this prior to, or prior on the show, but the very first time I ever saw anything WWF was the night after King of the Ring 96, when Stone Cold was making his entrance to accept his King of the Ring crown and sit in the throne. That was the very first time I ever watched WWF.
Okay.
So everything prior to that was WCW for some strange reason. I think that was just because that's what I saw at my grandmother's house. So to me, that's what wrestling was. So I would always watch that.
Okay.
I didn't know anything else prior to seeing Stone Cold, in June 98.
Right.
So, but I clearly I wasn't missing anything with Billy Jack Haynes.
No. All right, so the next match up, we had the Fabulous Rougeau Brothers, Shock and Raymond versus the Dream Team, Greg Valentine and Brutus Beefcake.
So this was the other really good match on this card. Besides the Snake Pit match, if you guys were going to watch anything on this card, I would recommend this one. Because despite the fact that I'm not too impressed with the Dream Team based on what I saw from them with WrestleMania 2, I have to admit that this was a very good showing for a tag team match in this time period.
Okay. And next we had, of course, King Harley Race coming off of his big King of the Ring victory the month prior. We had King Harley Race defeating Pedro Morales. And you know what? I'm not too familiar with Pedro's early work. I only caught him on the tail end of his career in WWF.
No, I mean, historically, I know what he did with the Intercontinental Championship, and
Yeah.
that's why his name has come up so much during Walter's run with the Intercontinental Championship. His name is not Gunther. At least they didn't stick with the Gunther Stark name. Just look that up and you'll figure out why.
Right.
But to be honest with you, like when I saw this match on the card prior to tuning in to this show, I was excited to see Harley Race versus Pedro Morales, and I was pissed the fuck off
Oh.
afterwards, because why was this match on the show? And for those of you that haven't seen this one, don't bother. Because if you're expecting a classic to live up to the legacies of both Harley Race and Pedro Morales, you ain't gonna get it with this one.
No.
And I'm not a guy that uses improper grammar, but I mean, this match doesn't even deserve proper English.
Look at the time, 3:23.
I mean, it's just ridiculous. Why was this match even put on there? I don't get it.
Now,
Clearly, if it's true what they're saying here, that both guys were way past their primes in this at this point in time, then why put them on the card at all? Why expose them in this fashion? It's just
you know, I'm gonna do some quick math here.
yeah.
40. Go on.
So while Elio is compiling his on the fly research, let me finish up the review with the main event
Hold
with
on a minute. Now, are you telling me that Harley Race was 43 years old, and that is old? Is that what you're telling me?
Well, apparently they're just saying they were way past their prime. Apparently in the 80s.
Is 43 way past your prime? I don't know.
Well, in pro wrestling, in that time frame, I would say yes.
Okay, I mean, even Pedro Morales was like just a few years younger than Harley Race at that time.
Well, that's why they said both guys were.
Yeah. All right, so
So I mean, I don't know. Based off this match, if you wanted me to answer this question based off this match, then the answer is yes.
okay. All right, so before we get into the main event, Ben, I sent you
Yeah.
a YouTube link. Did you watch that YouTube link I sent you?
Yes, I did.
What did I tell you? Storytelling.
Which was, and actually, I'm so glad that you did, because it helped me understand this match so much more.
Yep.
So I did just that little, 8 minute clip really helped me, understand what was going on in this situation, because, as much of a wrestling historian as I try to be, the fact is I just wasn't alive, at this point in time. So those little things really helped me figure out what's going on in these earlier time frames. And to be honest with you, my exposure to Paul Orndorff has been absolutely nothing, with the exception, I remember we did, I believe it was Halloween Havoc 93, way back on one of our
We did
retro. It
that. I think we did.
was either 92 or 93, but I remember Orndorff being on that show.
No, I think it was 93 because I have it in the bin somewhere, good corner
Okay, well
file.
then that's what it was. But yeah, so it really helped me to understand the feud before watching this match. And for like I said, I've never been a fan of Hulk Hogan,
Yep.
if I'm just being honest with you. I mean, I was a fan of his more during the NWO run. Because I think it just redefined wrestling at the time.
Yep.
But in terms of his in-ring work, I have never been a fan of Hulk Hogan.
Nope.
I would say the same about John Cena. That might be blasphemous to some people, and John Cena certainly has my respect much more than Hulk Hogan does. But I just have to be honest with you, from a wrestling perspective, both of those gentlemen have left much to be desired, from my perspective. But having said that, this match was entertaining. And
I
I think a lot of that had to do with Bobby Heenan and Paul Orndorff, who both played their roles tremendously.
And that is the big event. Now, Ben, I was thinking about this, and you know what this was? This, I think I want to say that this was like kind of an early experiment for SummerSlam, because being held in August, on August 28th, which is around the same time that SummerSlam usually takes place, the end of August. Only wasn't as great.
Yeah, and the when was the first SummerSlam? Well, that was, when was that? Was that 87 or 88?
That was Monday, August 29th, 1988.
Okay. So I wasn't too far off.
Yeah, so is that all we have for the big event?
Yes, sir.
All right, I'm going to read you something that from the aftermath.
Okay, cool.
So the following night, which was August 29th, the WWF hosted the Sam Mushnick Memorial Tournament, which Harley Race won by defeating Ricky Steamboat. And the Hogan-Orndorff feud continued to rage into the fall of 86, with Orndorff using Hogan's entrance theme, The Real American. And then there was a series of steel cage matches that followed, with the most highly publicized cage match taking place in December of 86 on the Saturday Night's Main Event. Now, that cage match was the one where I believe Orndorff was scaling up one side of the cage, Hogan scaled up the other side, and both were on the outside and were making their way down to the floor.
And which one got out first?
I believe I'm looking that up right now. It said the decision was inconclusive upon video replays. So
oh, okay.
There was no. It was Hogan getting the victory because they restarted the match.
Oh, okay.
And so what I was saying last week on Tuesday about this being the feud of the year for 86, PWI did name Hulk Hogan versus Paul Orndorff as feud of the year for 86.
Very cool.
All right.
Well, based on how far they were pushing it during this show, I get now. Granted, it was the main event, so that's what they do. They push the main event. But granted, how much they were focusing on that throughout the entire show, you could clearly see that match was that feud was a huge deal at that time.
Yeah, I just love the story leading up to this, like the way they told it.
Yeah.
So is that all we have for the big event then?
Absolutely.
All right. So that is it for Wrestling History 101. We will be back on Tuesday, and we will be traveling to Thursday, November 26th, I want to say, 1987, for the very
first... Let me just double check that date.
Yeah,
keep going.
We're going to do that for the very first WWF Survivor Series.
And was this the one where we ran into the gobbledygooker, or was that later?
Nope, that's in the '90s.
Okay, thank God.
It was November 26, 1987.
Okay.
So, however, prior to that, I'll just rhyme off the results of Royal Rumble 87, which was an experimental battle royal, which they call the Royal Rumble, and that's where we got the one we have today.
Okay.
So yeah, that one took place in St. Louis, Missouri. I want to say, yeah, St. Louis, Missouri.
What, the Royal Rumble?
Royal Rumble 87. I call it Royal Rumble 87 because it was a regular live event, but the Battle Royal, they had like no, they drew numbers 1 and 2 and so on.
Okay, let me see. Let me just double check that. Let's see. It what I have actually the match popped up, but let me see. Yes, it was in St. Louis. It was October
This,
4th. It was October 4th, 1987, at the Kiel Auditorium in St. Louis.
yep. So we will take a look at that one real quick, just the results, because I wish they had a pay-per-view or a video of that, because that would have been cool to see at the time.
Apparently, they actually do. It's on YouTube.
Oh, really?
With the user known as the Bionic Elbow.
What? Okay. Sure, why
So,
not?
yeah.
The bionic elbow. All right.
The benefits of on-the-fly research, folks.
Right. All right, so Ben, we see you bring this episode of Wrestling Because If You Want to Want to a close.
Absolutely.
All right, so that is it for another episode of Wrestling History 101. This is episode 4. I'm Elio, he's Ben. We will be back on Tuesday with Survivor Series 1987. Ben, see you
Class
next.
dismissed.
Roads, where we're going, we don't need roads.